Hi, this is Mark Snow, composer for the X-Files, and you are listening to the fabulous X-Cast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and this week we're covering the 7th episode of Season 2, 3. And it's a real pleasure to be joined once again after his interview on the X-Cast, all about the X-Files lexicon. It's great to have Matt Allaire join us for a brand new episode. So, hello Matt.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. Yeah, it's we're getting through the X-Cast pretty well so far. How have you been? How are things at the X-Files Lexicon?
We've been busy. I've got several interviews that are pending, and some other people are writing some stuff that's pending, and so we're just waiting to be able to run all that. Should have some more up before the end of the year. So
that's great. That's really, really good. Yeah, excellent. Anything like that, we'll make sure we promote on the podcast and on the X-Cast Facebook page and our blog, which is now available. So you can check that out if you just click on the X-Cast at Facebook. And you can find all that. And there are links on our Twitter as well at the X_cast. So, yeah, look out for that for more stuff on the X-Files lexicon as well. But we'll do some promotion later for the lexicon, Matt. Before then, let's get right into it and let's discuss Episode 7 of Season 2, 3. Three, as I say, is the 7th episode of Season 2 of The X-Files. It first aired on November the 4th, 1994. Was written by Chris Ruppenthal with Glenn Morgan and James Wong and was directed by David Nutter. The episode sees Mulder with Scully, a missing person, and an X-File herself going to Los Angeles in order to investigate some mysterious deaths that he's been tracking that may involve a cult of vampires.
Excuse me, sir. If I can ask your indulgence, this is a restricted crime scene.
Agent Mulder, I'm with the Bureau.
Nobody called the Bureau.
They should have.
Look, LAPD has seen, I don't know what, maybe a couple of weird crime scenes down the years. I think we can handle things.
There's no time for agency rivalries. I don't care about credit for the arrest or what goes on whose record. In the past year, these killers have murdered 6 people in 2 states. They only kill at night. By the end of the week, 2 more people will be dead and they will be gone.
Just how do you know all this?
There's a file on the previous murders. I've studied it. I've studied them. I've been waiting 3 months for them to reappear.
And just how can you be sure that these are the same killers?
The wire reported a body was found drained of blood. Bite marks on the exterior, jugular, and median cubital veins. Every mirror in the house was smashed.
Yeah, well, it's what the wire didn't report that distinguishes this scene.
There's writings on the wall, written in the victim's blood.
So, Matt, out of 10, what would you give 3?
I tend to rate it higher than a lot of other fans would. I would give it about a 7.
Yeah, now, I have to say, right, for years, I wasn't sure I liked 3. I really, really enjoyed this when I watched it for this podcast. So I would give it, I'm going to edge it a bit. I'm going to give it a 7.5. I really, really liked it. What is it about 3 that you like, Matt?
Well, a lot of fans, you know, a lot of the shippers especially, have always been upset with the episode because of Mulder's infidelity with Christian, the woman in the episode. But they miss a lot of the subtler things that are going on in the episode, and a lot of the themes that are going on in the episode. And if you actually kind of get past the shipper part of it, and I totally understand the fans that feel the way they do about the episode, but if you actually sort of separate that aspect, it's a really interesting episode. And there's a lot of really clever things that are going on in the episode, as well as some of the references that are, you know, in the episode, as far as the music that's used, and there's also a film that's referenced in the episode.
But yeah, there is a lot more going on in this than you might think, actually. And I really picked that up when I watched it this time round. I thought there was a surprising level of background detail and, you know, specific detail, especially regarding the idea of what the vampire means and what the vampire is as an entity. And this is, aside from a comedy episode, this is really the only time the X-Files ever does vampires, which is quite surprising, really, considering it ran for, well, it's still running, you know, for 20 odd years and 10 seasons. It's surprising they've never really done vampires after three in a serious way, isn't it?
Well, the only other exception would be the episode Patience, which is a later episode in the later seasons, and that really had to do more with a man-bat type situation, but there really hasn't been a lot of vampire episodes, you know, in the series.
And Patience was a good, solid, creepy episode, but yeah, it didn't touch on the same kind of vampire elements as three, which really does take the essential ideas of vampirism and really does a very, I'd say a modern, but it is a very 90s kind of underground sort of grungy element idea of what a vampire is. But it's, you know, it's pre-Twilight kind of vampire, really, pre-Buffy kind of vampire. But it's very good, and it still fits in terms of it really does have an effect, and it really does really get under the skin of the whole, you know, sexual nature of the vampire myth, which is, you know, if anything, this reminded me in places of the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula film with how these women go about everything. It has that sort of seductive element to it, which I think really works, actually. I think they really nail that throughout.
You know, the episode is often described as a takeoff on The Hunger, the Tony Scott film, but John Kenneth Muir also noted that if you look at the style, it's a lot like the Michael Mann films of the 80s, like Manhunter, where there's just a certain kind of look and sensibility, which makes the episode a little bit different from what you would typically, you know, expect to see from the X-Files. Not usually, but just enough to where it makes it, you know, an odd, you know, kind of episode within the canon, within everything else that we've seen with the episode with the X-Files before.
Do you think those inspirations are intentional, or do you know that they might be specifically intentional?
Well, all I really know is I know that Glenn and James had commented about The Hunger before. I mean, I don't know if the other things that I mentioned necessarily are conscious, but I mean, there's often with TV and film, there's often a lot of unconscious inspiration. So, I mean, I just sort of find the way that the episode is presented is really interesting. So I wanted to notate that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it surprises me when I know it's not the be and end all of all things, but it surprises me when I go on IMDb and I see that an aggregate for three out of 2,388 votes is only 6.6 out of 10, which is one of the lowest rated. In fact, it might be the lowest rated episode. Yeah, it is. It's the lowest. No, actually, The only Fearful Symmetry is lower on IMDb series season two than this. And I think that's woefully wrong, really. I mean, Excelsis Day, for a start, is way worse. That's a really bad episode.
Did you notice that it's either a space of 3 or 4 months, but did you notice in the opening where Mulder's been away from work for that long? I always found that interesting that the FBI would allow him to take that long of a sabbatical, you know, after Scully's abduction. So, you know, I always thought that was, you know, an interesting aspect, so to speak.
Yeah, it is. It is curious how you have that time jump, essentially, but it's not only made specific through a specific calendar. That seems like a pretty good jumping off point to actually talk about the episode in more detail. So let's get into it and go into depth on three. We start off with the teaser. I mean, you can tell, actually, that this is a David Nutter episode, I think, because he's a very good director, and he's put a lot in the X-Files episodes he's done so far. He's added a little extra level, like Rob Bowman does, and like Kim Manners later goes on to do. But I think one of the best teasers we've had yet of the show, because it really gets across the whole sort of style and template of this episode with the, you know, the heat and the redness of Los Angeles And straight away, you see fire. You see the fiery shot, stock footage, don't you, of Los Angeles. It's all there.
Right. Well, David is such an amazing director. It doesn't surprise me at all to see him working on, like, Game of Thrones and some of these other things where he's been working on it. And he's always been such an amazing director that I sometimes think fans tend to overlook what a great director he was, not only with The Exiles, but then with everything that he's done afterwards.
Yeah, because like you say, he did Game of Thrones, especially as well, which is one of my favourite shows. And he's been, I mean, he did the pilot of Millennium as well, didn't he, I believe?
Yes, he did.
So he's one of these directors who's got a real legacy in television. I think that there aren't many TV shows from the 90s and the noughties that David Nutter has not been involved with, and beyond, to be fair. So he does have that level of quality. And that's why I think what I really like about 3, it's all in the teaser, is that this actually feels a bit different from anything we've had in the X-Files before. And it feels like the kind of episode that you could only do without Scully, weirdly, because it really sort of gets under Mulder's skin a lot, and it very much sort of, for me, it parallels his descent into this really sort of dark space where he can't quite get a hold of himself. And I think right from the start, when you see this man, Garrett, become completely seduced by the vampire bride lady, who I think is one of the Trinity, it feels like that could be Mulder, or that might be Mulder later on.
What's interesting is this is sort of like a very atypical episode, but historically, like for instance with 60s Star Trek, there were a couple of atypical episodes with Star Trek, as well as Patrick McGowan's The Prisoner, where at least there was two episodes that were very atypical. And so it's sort of following in the tradition of series that sort of jump off and do something that's just not the norm of what you'd expect. And so, you know, it's really interesting that they're carrying on this kind of tradition of willing to try something new and take a gamble and, you know, do something that is not going to be what the fans are expecting to see.
Yeah, and as you say, might well annoy a lot of the fans who are already doing the ship with Mulder and Scully. And, you know, not only is Scully not in this one at all, but Mulder basically gets a new, not girlfriend, but a new love interest. And that's something that very, very seldom ever happens in The X-Files. And then later on in the show, it always, or quite often, becomes a comedic touch point with people like Bambi, Berenbaum, or the detective in Syzygy. You know, all of these women who come into his life, and there's a lot of comedy played in Scully's reaction to another woman cropping up. But in this, he genuinely is seduced by Kristen, and that's something that right from the very beginning, with all of the imagery, the blood red wine, the glamour of Hollywood, you know, the dark glamour of it, the you know, the man, this guy Garrett in the teaser, who is basically apologizing for the fact he sent his family away so he can have illicit sex with a vampire bride. Not that he knows she's a vampire. It's all just there straight away. And I think that you get that very typical vampire idea of seduction and of mystery and of blood mixed with the savagery of it, because obviously at the end he gets slaughtered in his hot tub. Yeah, it just encapsulates, it just crystallizes the episode, I think.
I just want to go back to, it's interesting with a lot of the shipper fans that are always upset with him having the affair is, you know, Scully essentially does something very similar when season 4 with Never Again, with having her affair with that she meets. And so it's like there's more latitude given towards that episode than this episode. It's always been interesting to me.
It's funny because when I was watching 3, there was a point where I actually thought to myself, this is Mulder's Never Again. I actually said that in my head. This is Scully does get her own 3 in 2 seasons time, but it's just played differently. That's a good point. That's very true. So yeah, once we're at the teaser, we're in the main chunk of the episode, and Mulder's, as you mentioned earlier, Matt, Mulder comes into his office and we have this passage of time. So it's now November, and we see the X-Files office, I think, for the first time actually this season, and it's covered in all this, there's lots of clear covering over the desk to prevent dust going on it and everything like that, and Mulder pulls it up and you see his name on his badge, and it's a reintroduction to the office essentially, as Mulder puts away Scully's case file into the X-Files, which is a really sort of somber moment for him, isn't it?
Oh, and also what's interesting in that part is there's this scene of Mulder thumbing through a calendar of women, scantily clad women, and all that. So you get to see a little bit of that, hint a little bit of that, that aspect to him.
All holding weapons as well. Did you notice that? They're either a gun or a hacksaw.
It can plays into the idea of the episode, sort of playing with sex and violence and whatnot, and nihilism. And
oh yeah, there's a great deal of nihilism in this, absolutely. but there is that element of hope, isn't there? Because he keeps Scully's cross, and obviously, you know, given we're dealing with an episode with vampires, which the teaser is pretty much laid out there, that we know the idea of vampires, we know that we're dealing with vampires as viewers. That symbolism of the cross isn't just about Scully. It's the whole idea of putting the cross, like in Dracula, towards a vampire and having them shrink away. You know, it's the defense, isn't it, against evil. So it works on both levels.
Well, it also symbolizes Scully, and it represents the light. It represents the positive, because in a lot of ways, Scully, you know, is light, and she's the one that kind of keeps his worst tendencies in check throughout the entire series. So
yeah, it does work on different levels, definitely. But there's a real feeling when he's in that office that things have changed. When Scully obviously first came in, he was quite fine working on his own, you know, as he had done after Diana Fowley ultimately left working with him on the X-Files, and we don't quite know the timeline of that fully, but it was before obviously Scully got there. But he'd been working on his own for a while, and so he was fine. And then Scully comes in and he's got this new partner, but now he's on his own and he just doesn't, you know, he puts her file away, he puts her badge away, keeps the cross, but so much has changed for him. And then the phone rings and he's off to Los Angeles, and it's just, I suppose this is his reaction, he's throwing himself into his work, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, you could say that, but, you know, and, you know, if you look at Mulder in the pilot episode, there's a certain kind of, you know, arrogant independence. He doesn't really want to be bothered with anybody else. And so what you've seen with Scully is what she gradually had done throughout the first season. She had humanized him in a way where, even though it was a platonic relationship, I mean, clearly they really kind of needed each other. And that's what's, I mean, her absence in this episode was really palpable. And you really sort of see that, you know, that's the thing that the fans criticized the episode the most for, is actually the point of it, is that that her absence is really felt, and you really see how easily lost he can become when she's not present.
Yeah, it's so true. That's what this episode does the best, really, and that's why I think people overlook it a bit too often, because it's only one episode we get where Mulder, where she's not here. You know, it would have been interesting if they'd have done half the season or a quarter of the season where he's on his own. Not, they didn't need to. They did it. Three is a really good encapsulation of what happens to Mulder when she's not with him. But they could have done more episodes with him on his own or working with other partners. But it wouldn't have been as good. This works because it's one episode where she's not there, and he gets too involved. Ultimately, he really does lose that distance to what's going on. And I think this really does show that really, really well. But then I thought what also was good was, when we get to Los Angeles, I think, because we've talked about this earlier in the season on the X-Cast, how Vancouver does and doesn't sometimes look like where it's supposed to be. But I think they do a pretty good job of making you believe you're in smoky Los Angeles. What do you think? You live around that, you know, you live in that part of the world, essentially, don't you? So, yeah. Did they do a good job?
Well, I live briefly in Los Angeles, so, I mean, I never lived in some of the affluent areas in Los Angeles. So, I mean, I think it captured LA to a point, but it's capturing LA during a crisis. So, because of the fire and all that. So what you're getting is he's walking into this very unstable situation that, you know, and I don't think it's an accident that it's set during a fire and that there's all the fire motifs. And, you know, I mean, I counted about, aside from all the bloodletting sequences, there's about 15 motifs of like red motifs, like fire or just lighting, or just images of red throughout the episode, as well as to a certain lesser degree blue and violet, you know, in the episode. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting with how David Nutter worked on the look of the episode. Is there's all these real clever, and I think it's sort of done a little bit with a bit of sense of humor, but there's all these sort of clever visual motifs that are in there as far as, you know, fire and blood and passion and all that, and kind of a misplaced passion. It's not really like, because it's almost like with Mulder's affair, it's the wrong kind of a direction. It's not a healthy kind of pursuit of a sexual relationship. It's something that's not quite right. And so visually, there's a lot of little just subtle things which are played out just in the episode as far as how various things are presented and all that. And there's also the breaking glasses and things like that, which are the wine glasses are one thing, but there's also the smashed mirrors and all that, which is, of course, part of the vampire lore.
Yeah, the visually, like, yeah, you're absolutely right. There is so much that David Nutter puts in here in terms of symbolism, in terms of visual, iconic imagery, in terms of, he really wants to get across the idea that we're dealing with vampires, but in a very contemporary way. I mean, I think the word vampire is used maybe three times in the entire script. It's very much not, they're not described in those terms. The myths are there, the symbolism is there, the visual imagery is there, but Nutter is, and alongside the script as well, which I think is undervalued, is working well to try and sell you a story that is much more about obsession and about addiction, I think, more than anything else, which we'll get to later, which again ties into the bigger themes of Mulder's character and the X-Files in general. But yeah, using that visual element with Los Angeles, I think making it look smoky and making it look hot and tying it in with fire, I think is a really good idea, actually. So Mulder's on the case, and he's got to jump ahead of everyone else because he has already been tracking what is known as the Unholy Trinity beforehand. That's a relatively new thing, isn't it? There's not many cases where he's necessarily been tracking them for a while specifically. He might have heard similar cases before, or he might have heard of the paranormal element before, but it's not often he's tracking the same people, is it?
Indeed. Well, I mean, there's obviously like a behavioral pattern because they're traveling from, I think, one state was Oregon, and there's like several states that when he's doing his investigation of Kristen, you know, obviously she's been part of this circle that's been traveling from state to state doing what they're doing. So
yeah, I suppose it kind of goes back to his days in violent crimes, doesn't it? You know, where he would track serial killers and things like this. So in some respects, it's a little bit of a nod to that, I guess.
No, I mean, I totally agree. You know, it just reminds the audience of his criminal profiling background and the fact that he can, you know, like observe behavioral patterns within people.
And obviously, when he gets to the crime scene, the cop is a little bit brittle at first at him turning up, and we didn't call the FBI, you know, and he's like, but then he's got all this information based on the fact he's been tracking these guys, and the guy at the end pulls back and sort of says, yeah, that's fine. I appreciate all the information. We clearly don't know as much as you. We can get you some help. And he's like, I don't need any help. I work alone. And it's different from when he's talking about working alone in the opening few episodes of the season, when the X-Files are shut down and he'll turn to someone like Krycek and say, I work alone. He still knows he's got Scully.
Right.
This case, he really is alone, and he doesn't want anyone else involved because he can't. He's still trying to deal with what's happened to her. And I thought that was and there's a few more lines later on, like when he turns around and he says, "I don't sleep anymore." It's that level that he's lost that control again, isn't it?
Right. Indeed. Exactly.
So yeah, he's on the case, and he started to track down the blood banks, and he uses what I think might be my favorite pseudonym Mulder ever uses when he calls up the Hollywood Blood Bank. And uses the name Marty Mulder.
Right, yes.
I love that. But yeah, this is again where now this is the first instance of Mulder now starting to really hunt down the Trinity, essentially. And he goes to the blood bank and he finds John eating drinking the blood out of the blood bag, which is just a horrible, moment, isn't it? There's some real sort of visual horror imagery in this episode, isn't there? Like with where Johnny's eating that blood, drinking that blood. It's horrible, isn't it?
Well, what's clever is that Mulder, instead of just walking into danger, he actually uses that little mirror with the piece, and then sort of, you know, creeps in there and looks around before he actually makes himself visible. So, you know, and that's probably, you know, his FBI training, but it's like, you know, it's a little tool to assess danger before he walks right in, you know, armed. So it shows his ingenuity, and some people would have just not thought about it. They just would have just barged in, and then he's just careful enough because he knows he's possibly dealing with something really dangerous where he'll do something like that.
Yeah, it was a nice little touch, actually. Yeah, that's true. This ultimately leads him to capturing John, who he's also known as the Sun, as he describes to Mulder when he's being interrogated. So there's the Sun, the Father, and the Unholy Spirit, which is a really good take on the biblical element from the Lord's Prayer and things like that, which is really clever. And it's I think it gets to the idea, doesn't it, of what the essential idea of a vampire is, of someone who represents a certain biblical evil in a way. And I think the idea of having that is really interesting in this episode.
Well, the interesting thing about that quote from the scriptures for 6.54 is he's obviously distorting the meaning of what that was about, because I mean, historically, vampirism is, you know, basically the inverse of the Catholic Eucharist or the Supper of Christ, because the Last Supper was, you know, Christ talking about the symbolic meaning of the wafer being the body and the wine being the blood, and it's about, you know, it's about spiritual immortality after you die. And of course, with vampirism, that's the total opposite. So that character, the Sun, he's sort of misinterpreting or distorting the meaning of the idea of immortality. Because obviously you're taking life for your own gains. You're giving up your soul, you know, by doing that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That really is fascinating, that he's changing the meaning of biblical imagery and calling himself, you know, after a prophet and everything like that. It is great, and it does add extra depth to, you know, he's and John's philosophy is really nihilistic, you know, and you get this great scene with Mulder where John's panicking because they're shining lights on him, and he says, I can't do this. And then Mulder comes in with the red lights, and then because he has that innate understanding of, even though he doesn't necessarily believe they're vampires, he knows to play, as he says, to play into John's delusion. He will do the things that make him feel better. So he puts that red light on. But John's philosophy is really, really nihilistic to the extreme. And I get the sense that's how he justifies his actions.
Oh, indeed. Well, you know, the other thing about John's line in the interrogation where he's saying, there's no heaven, there's no soul, just rot and decay. You know what reminds me of, and I know this is going to sound odd, is it reminds me of like something that you'd see from one of Clive Barker's books or his films, the kind of character philosophy. You could see that in Hellraiser or subsequently Lord of Illusions, you know, and a lot of people, I don't think, pick up on that. That's one of the things that line of is, you know, followed by the source of money, which is very nihilistic as well. And if you go back to Hellraiser, again, it also ties into the idea of sexual indulgence gone awry. And it goes into, and you know, plenty of people have had like little flings or whatever. And what usually happens is after a while, you begin to realize that with a lot of flings, it starts to ring hollow after a while. And so what this episode does, and with like Clive Barker and other people have done, is they talk about, you know, that, you know, you can only indulge in the flesh for so long unless there's an emotional connection. It just starts to ring empty and all that. So I thought that was an interesting thing that I picked up on, you know, watching this.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And it makes me wonder if any Hellraiser specific and Clive Barker specific connections again were part of the DNA of the episode, because as you say, you know, there were inspirations to Michael Mann stuff, there was inspirations with The Hunger, so it's quite possible that bleakness in Clive Barker's work could have seeped into this as well as part of the parts that they create for this. I definitely, again, I can definitely see some Morgan and Wong influences in this, You know, it's lines like where John says to Mulder, "Don't you want to live forever?" And Mulder comes back with, "Not if drawstring pants come back into style."
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just those great. they really know how to do the one-liners with Mulder really, really well, perhaps better than anybody. So you can see their influences in this as well. I also thought it was interesting. I don't know if you spotted this, but I thought it was interesting how John seems to be able to be visible in a mirror, and Mulder sort of, you know, John says, I can't be seen in a mirror, but Mulder can see him in a mirror.
Right.
That was interesting.
Well, it plays into, it raises the question of, are they really vampires, or are they just so fervent in their belief that, I mean, it makes the character, the son, look like he's really delusional. The fact that he's insisting, oh, I can't be seen in a mirror, and yet obviously he can. So you're forced to assume, okay, well, this is just some crazy guy doing this. And then that leads into the next part of what happens, you know, following that exchange,
where he gets deep fried basically by the sunlight, or as we see, he seems to die, which is what we think for quite a while, which really horrible. I mean, really, really well put together by the visual effects team and by the production team, you know, with makeup and effects and everything like that. But to see his flesh burning, it's really, this episode really doesn't pull the punches quite often. There's some real horror in this one.
Yeah, it was a pretty ghoulish thing. And then obviously obviously right after that, Mulder, it's because Scully isn't there, Mulder mentions Gunther's disease and Pryorgia and some of those other conditions that historically have explained the origin of where vampire belief probably started off. What's interesting to me about that sequence is it also plays on the idea of the mind-body relationship, in as far as this guy so fervently believes he's a vampire that you could look at it like, well, his mind or his brain literally tells his body, you're burning up. So, I mean, at that point, you're not sure if it's just that he may be a vampire. He very likely may not be. And it's really interesting, because if you go back to, a lot of doctors have argued with the mind-body relationship that, you know, whenever you have a serious illness, or like a life-threatening illness, it's extremely important to have a positive attitude about overcoming it. And so what Glenn and James seem to be doing is they're sort of playing on that idea of that of the mind-body relationship in that sequence. Of course, he reappears later on, that character, but it just is interesting that you see that being kind of played around with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is that suggestion, and of course, you know, Mulder doesn't believe. It's ironic, really. He doesn't really believe in vampires. You know, he says that. He says, "I just thought they were myth." You know, after John seemingly dies, which surprised me, because I would always think that vampires, the basic paranormal things, are the things Mulder would believe in. You know, I would have assumed he would believe in vampires.
You know, the episode is playing with a lot of the myths. In the same way that later on, Bad Blood also played with a lot of the typical wives' myths about vampirism. And so there's a couple of things in there. There's the, the blood pudding or the bread pudding, the blood bread that you see in the oven later on, and all that. And that's another part of the whole, there's a whole list of rules and myths about protecting yourself against vampires and all that stuff. So it's interesting that they're playing so much with that. It's not quite to the degree they do with Bad Blood, but they are definitely sort of addressing some of those myths and what happens when people kind of buy into those.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the way Mulder starts to come to understand, well, this is the thing, all the way through, he's trying to understand and see if they really are what they say they are. And it's part of what leads him down the rabbit hole when he soon meets Kristen. But just before that, I thought there was a really interesting scene where he has a scene with the doctor after John's been killed, or seemingly been killed, and the doctor's basically almost filling the Scully role in a way, to some extent, because he's talking about alternative theories about what could have happened. But Mulder shuts him down very quickly, and in a way that he wouldn't have done with Scully. And he kind of just reacts in a different way, and that's when he basically turns around and says, you know, he doesn't believe in them. And then the man, but he comes across, but even by mentioning it, the doctor says, "You're really upsetting me on several levels," which made me laugh. But that almost seemed to be a scene which shows that it's not just Scully's ideas that help fuel Mulder and give him this back and forth, but it's the way she presents it, it's the way she does it, and he can't really have that relationship with anybody else. That's the kind of vibe I got from that.
You know, indeed, yeah. Well, I mean, it did lead to him the business with you know, pulling off the skin and finding Teps, and that does lead to him going to, you know, Club Teps and all that, which is the next really interesting, you know, sequence or scene in the episode.
Yeah, because he's the club is named, seems to be named for Vlad Teps, who's also Vlad the Impaler, who of course was the inspiration for Dracula. And it's interesting that something I noticed, which is around on online, but Kristen's surname is Killar, which is the same surname as the guy who scored the Francis Ford Coppola Bram Stoker's Dracula film. So that could well be a nod to that, really. A fantastic film, beautiful score. But yeah, there's lots of little allusions and connections. I kept wondering, and you may know the answer to this, Matt, I kept wondering about the movie that was playing when Mulder walks into Club Tepes, because I'm sure it's Orson Welles.
Well, the movie, I believe the movie's actually Fritz Lang's M. I mean, it's like one scene from Fritz Lang's M, I believe, is what's playing in there.
Okay. I was wondering, I kept thinking, is that The Third Man? But this just shows my lack of Orson Welles film knowledge.
No, but, so it would be, you know, the silent film that Fritz Lang did in the 1920s. So yeah, no, because somebody else, Sarah Siegel actually was one of the first people that observed, they're showing a clip from M. So, I mean that's really interesting. And do you know the band that's actually, there's two pieces of music in the club sequence, and second piece, do you know the band that's performing that music?
No, I don't, actually.
That's actually X, the LA band X, and the name of the song is The Unheard Music.
Oh, wow, okay. That's
and
cool.
Of course, that band X, they later on contributed to the soundtrack of Fight the Future as far as the cover of The Crystal Ship. So it's interesting that they would have, and either the writers or Chris Carter or one of them must have liked that band, because it's interesting that piece of music would be selected. Although when I looked up the lyrics, because they're all very stream of conscious, I don't necessarily see a direct, how the song directly connects with the rest of the theme of the episode, unless the song just simply, you know, playing into the whole nihilistic aspect that's in that episode.
Yeah, perhaps it could be. Maybe it's just adding to the very sort of neo-gothic 90s alternative vibe to Club Tepes, which Mulder's just so out of place in at first. You know, when he goes there in his buttoned up FBI suit and then approaches Kristen, he really doesn't fit at all. And that's the whole point, really, that he's continuing to go down this rabbit hole. Obviously, as most people probably know, Kristen's played by Perry Reeves, who at the time was David Duchovny's real-life girlfriend, wasn't she? So the chemistry between these two is terrific, really. And it's one of the better dynamics, I think, between guest character and one of the lead actors. In fact, it might be the best one, actually, that touches on the sexual aspect and the sexual tension than anyone else they played off that wasn't each other, Duchovny and Anderson, really. They're really good together in this. And whenever they're on screen, there is that, you feel that, those characters together. It works very well.
Well, it's Sarah Siegel in her review of Three. She commented about how good David's performance was and how the interplay between her and Perry Reeves, you know, in the later scenes with, you know, the bedroom scenes, you know, it's all in body language and in eye contact and there's just a lot of subtle things that are going on with David, which is why, you know, actually I think he delivers a very good performance, especially in the later half of the episode. And so, And obviously several other people have noticed the very same thing.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Yeah, I think he's often underrated as an actor anyway, David Duchovny. But I think when he gets something that really gives him the opportunity to push Mulder into different places. He really does rise up to the plate. And this is one of those episodes where Mulder is pushed into an unconventional area. I mean, it's that whole first scene with Kristen, where she says to him, you know, you've lost someone, not a lover, a friend. Again, it's coming back to the sexual idea. And it strikes me that if Mulder didn't have Scully as a partner, I think his own natural sex appeal and his own natural attraction would get him into more situations like this. Because obviously Mulder's, for the most part, he's quite an asexual character on the face of it. You know, he has the porn addiction and things like that, which kind of channels, I think, that kind of stuff for a long time, because he's too busy on all the other things. But he's a very handsome man. You know, he wouldn't have a problem attracting women. And it feels like because Scully's there and he can channel himself into the work, he can put that aside and he can put that in a box. But if Scully wasn't there, I think more Kristens would get him into trouble, basically. So obviously then Kristen pulls out the needle which involved in the injection. And this is the point, I think, where the blood becomes, for me, the cocaine swap out. There's the whole idea of addiction here, and it ties into the idea of you know, drug addiction in general, which obviously is prevalent in a lot of different shows. But it is that idea that blood, for Kristen, is tied into her psychology with sex, and obviously later on we find out about the abuse she suffered as a child and growing up and everything. And it's all tied into that, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is. There's the little exchange where Mulder is asking her, well, what about AIDS? And she kind of just laughs him off and walks away and goes with another guy. So it's sort of like, because obviously that was still the big issue at the time, was still is today. But I mean, you know, it was that she's not really concerned about the danger, the mortal danger of something like that. It's an interesting little revealing moment.
Yeah, actually, yeah. AIDS is definitely another component here. And that idea of, funnily enough, the idea of protection seems to be quite prevalent throughout this in different kinds of ways. You know, Mulder is concerned about that from the, you know, the blood and the sexual point of view. But later on, it's in terms of the fact that it almost feels like he has a need to try and protect Kristen as well. Perhaps in a way that he couldn't protect Scully, or he can't protect Scully. And I think that's interesting. It's not just the sexual attraction here. There's a lot more to it, really. You know, it's simplistic to just think that Scully's gone, Mulder falls in with and has sex with another woman. That's not quite what it is. It's much more tied up to his psychology of where he is at right now, because he's lost somebody. And that's what's really interesting about this.
Well, I wanted to kind of just jump on and mention, like, the next, one of the next sequences, which is the Raw restaurant. It's really interesting that they would use reference to Ra and the Egyptian motif.
Yes.
Because, you know, in Egyptology, you know, Ra was the creator, and what people may not know is that when Ra enters the underworld, he often merges with Osiris, the god of the dead, you know, and of resurrection, and so it's sort of an interesting, you know, it plays on this idea of light and dark, yin and yang. Mm. So even though there's not really any other significant to that reference, it's interesting that, again, that you're playing with you know, light and dark and whatnot. So I just wanted to, you know, pass that on.
No, because, well, that stuck out to me, actually. And I'm glad you've expanded on that, really, because it struck me as not being coincidental. That's there for a reason, even though it's just a subtle thing. It's definitely there to tie, as you say, tie into the whole idea of death and resurrection, which is another key component to what we get to as Mulder basically gets his ass kicked by the guy who then gets savaged by by the Trinity after Kristen has lured them in. And we realise that she's, to some extent, the bait for this vampire cult of killers. But it's then really that we get to the point where Mulder starts to get to know Kristen. I thought the choice he makes, where when he manages to find where Kristen and the Trinity are living and where they're based out of, which is this really big, soulless, you know, house.
with a lot of white.
Yes, with a lot of light. Yeah, actually, because there's a lot of contrast between light and dark in this episode. But I thought it was interesting the way he intentionally sidefoots the cops, and he goes his own way, and he doesn't tell them. He sort of says, "Oh no, they're not going to come back here. Leave it." And he knows full well that they will. And he's there waiting for Kristen. I thought that's the kind of thing he wouldn't do either when when he's with Scully.
He would have, I mean, otherwise he would have normally had gotten the cops to case the place and stay as she appeared. So, you know, he's willing to walk into danger by him being alone with her, during that sequence.
Yeah, and he's honest with her, and he says to her, they're on to you, basically. Because much as he does want to, you know, he hasn't gone native, so as it were. He hasn't, you know, betrayed anybody. But he's also, he is a bit seduced by her. And he is a bit seduced by the idea that he wants to try and protect her, you know. And he obviously, he's got the cross around him still. And he's wearing the cross. And he's open-necked as well, I thought was interesting. He looks much more like the kind of guy that she'd pick up in the club. He's not the FBI agent at this point. You know, he's got the cool suit, which is open-necked. It's a lot more relaxed Mulder, which, again, you don't see very often, really.
So I kind of wanted to talk. I wanted to talk about the ending a little bit as far as, you know, when the house catches on fire, there's a very apocalyptic element to that part of it. And what I mean by apocalyptic as far as the textbook definition of uncovered, covering, the lifting of the veil for disclosure of knowledge. And so, in a way, that episode is almost like Mulder's Heart of Darkness, where you know, he kind of faces this Heart of Darkness and rejects it.
That's really true. That element of purging and of, you know, Kristen, when she ultimately, you know, she's talked about how she was abused herself, and it's kind of what led her to this role of not being one of the Trinity, but being part of what they're doing and potentially wanting to be immortal. And then when John turns up again, he's talking about how, you know, they can live forever. You know, they can be resurrected in almost like a Jesus kind of way, in almost kind of a biblical sense. We can't die. We are, you know, we're given this gift of life, and it's tied in very heavily with death. And it is interesting how she then, that action she takes, where she intentionally gives her own life, either to become one of them or to stop them. You know, I think there's an element of both, really, is what ties into Mulder's purging of emotion and purging of how he's feeling right now. And it's a really good ending that. Oh, has the typical action beats, you know, but it does have more going on, you know, involved in terms of the psychology of Mulder and of the guest characters, really.
So I would argue that the reason why 3 is a better vampire episode than something like a more beloved episode than like Bad Blood, which is really loved by the fans, and I totally understand the reasons why Bad Blood is so beloved, but my reasons why I think 3 is a better vampire episode is that it follows the early criteria of what Chris Carter was talking about, which is that it's scary, but it's also within the realm of real world plausibility.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I mean, Bad Blood is a very, very different animal anyway. You know, Bad Blood is taking the mick out of it, really. You know, it's lampooning the idea of the vampire. It's intentionally played for laughs, whereas this is trying to do its own contemporary take on the idea of the vampire myth without being a traditional, you know, camped up sort of Hammer horror kind of, you know, Dracula, a really cheesy kind of episode that a lot of shows would have done before the postmodern sort of, you know, Buffy element of what a vampire became in the public consciousness in this time. So the fact it does that in 1994 and does its own very dark, very gothic, neo-gothic, very sort of horror-based episode is why I think, which ties again, as we've said, into Mulder's psychology, I think is very good. And I think it's misplaced by a lot of people. I think it's underappreciated. And when you go back and do a series watch and you can appreciate it, I think it visually, and in terms of symbolism, it could be one of the best episodes of season 2 in that sense. And I certainly think it deserves to be remembered much, much highly than people think.
Well, if you notice, there's never any fangs that are seen in the episode. They use syringes or there's appendages. So you don't get the typical iconography. You know, it's interesting that you never, in the series with the X-Files, you never actually see people growing or spouting fangs. It's more like they have to have some other means of extracting the blood and all that.
Absolutely. And then, you know, we get the final moment of Mulder, the house has gone up, explosion. Mulder's the next morning in the wreckage, just sitting on the edge of this hillside, and a fireman comes up to him and says, there's just ashes and bones. So definite confirmation that they are all dead. There is no ambiguity there. They are all just cremated at that point. And he just looks at the cross. You know, in some respects, it's like good. The good has triumphed over evil, but it doesn't feel that simple, really. And it's not that simple. And whether or not he feels that purge, or he feels, I think it's just that he feels that loss and that loneliness still even more powerful. Actually, he formed some kind of twisted. And as you said, it wasn't a proper connection with Kristen. It wasn't a healthy relationship, but he formed some kind of connection with her, and she's gone as well. He couldn't protect her. And I think it plays into that even more with him.
Well, I mean, again, it goes back to, by Mulder holding Scully's cross, she's representing the light, and he's reminded that he has to keep pursuing something that's much more positive than where he ends up in that episode.
I think that's absolutely true. And it's a good place to leave things before One Breath, which obviously brings Scully back, and we get back into the status quo really after that. So it's a good examination of Mulder, and I think overall, as I say, 3 is an episode that deserves some good merit really. So yeah, that's our in-depth look at 3.
We'll rise up. You can't kill us. You're not one of us.
But I will be. I'm tasting the blood of a believer.
But you haven't taken a life.
I'll take
mine. So before we go, there's a couple of little things. Firstly, as I do when we have a relevant paranormality to the episode, I ask my guest the question, do you believe him? Which is all about the specific weirdness and supernatural of the episode. So Matt, put simply, do you believe in vampires?
You know, there's a lot of things that scientifically have explained why people in the medieval times would believe that such a thing exists. But it goes back to the Jungian and Freudian thing about, you know, duality and light and dark and the natural. This is with werewolves and lycanthropy. It's the same idea of, you know, the beast within us all and keeping that beast in check. So I don't know that there's such thing as actual vampires, but you know there is definitely a culture of vampire fetishism. So I mean that is because of the popularity of Dracula, all the films that have come out that just deal with vampires, and you know there's an element to the whole vampire thing that is very appealing to people and has an element that's kind of cool. But of course the trade-off is, you know, you're sacrificing someone else's life for your own.
Yeah, and there's a reason that vampires have stayed in the pop culture consciousness for this long, you know, all the way back to Nosferatu in the 20s, and have come through in that sense, because I think that there's something that stays with you with a vampire. You know, they are the ultimate monster in terms of the paranormal and the supernatural. You know, they would be the first monster that people would probably recall if somebody said, name a classic, you know, supernatural monster. The vampire has all these elements that are really seductive to people, not just the sexuality of them. And that's not always been the case, you know, in every vampire. But going back to things like Dracula, there was always that element of charm and seduction and romance and dark romance, and all the way to, obviously, through to the, you know, the female empowerment of something like Buffy, where she was fighting vampires, to the teen romance of Twilight. You know, it covers a lot of bases and a lot of things that really connect with people on different levels and at different ages. And I think it's why, even though the vampire as an idea probably just is based in myth in the real world, I think that the effect that it's had on the world in terms of myth is one of the strongest, really, and one of the deepest.
Yeah, it's true. It is. It's really interesting. But I mean, again, with vampirism, you know, it's again about sexual taboo and about pleasure without any consequence for that pleasure. You know, and so, I mean, it's interesting that that's been playing out long before things like the AIDS epidemic came up, where actually, you know, there is now real consequence.
So yeah, the vampire is a powerful mythological symbol, really, and it's well realized in this episode. So yeah, before we do go, one last thing, Matt. I think it's time to have a go at the X quiz. So five questions and a quote on three.
Oh God, okay.
So hopefully these won't be too bad, but this is the part that everyone dreads when they come on the show. but we've talked about a couple of these, so yeah, you might be okay with this. So let's see. Okay, are you ready?
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Question one. What is the Bible quote chapter and psalm number painted in blood on the first victim's wall?
Well, that was the quote from John 6:54. You know, whoever drinks of my blood and eats of my flesh will eternally live.
Brilliant. You see, I only needed the actual number. And you gave the whole quote, which is brilliant. I should give you 2 points. So yeah, okay, number one, good. Okay, question two. Who was, as Mulder's describing the list of victims the Trinity have claimed early on, who did he say the third murder victim was?
Oh, God. I remember the state better than I remember the name. Yeah. I think I wrote that down. Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't answer that one.
That's all right. That's okay. He says, because he rattles off a few different people. He says the third one is a Jesuit theologian, which
that's
stuck
right.
with me because, yeah, it stuck with me because it's obviously, you know, a religious man. So it was interesting how that was the target, really. Okay, question three. What does Mulder claim he can make appear from behind the doctor's ear?
A quarter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or a penny, yeah, or it's either a quarter or a penny, but it...
No, yeah, it's a quarter, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, cool, okay. Question four. The actor who plays, this is a slightly production question, but I'm cheating here. The actor who plays the same doctor, who Mulder's talking to, I think it's the same doctor anyway, Ken Kramer, also played a character in which season one episode? Also played a doctor in which season one episode of The X-Files?
Well, he reminds me of Dr. Berube from Erlenmeyer Flask. Looks similar.
Yeah. So that's the guy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That's him. Yeah. Dr. Berube, yeah. From the Erlenmeyer Flask. So you know, you're doing all right here, Matt. You've got 3 out of 4. That's not bad. That's pretty good going.
Okay.
Next question. At what time in the early hours of the morning does Kristen enter her house and find Mulder there?
I like to say 10:13 p.m., but I'm I can't quite remember if it was a bit later. I think it might have been a little about 12:30 or something like that.
You're not a million miles away. It's 2:15 a.m. There's a lot of clocks. There's a lot of specific times in this episode. You do get that sometimes in some X-Files, but there seems to be a lot of specific times come up. So yeah, 2:15 p.m. Okay, finally the quote. Okay, so if you can try and get the guess who it is and in what scene, that'd be great. So, here we go. When a snake eats a fly, it's not murder, it just is.
The sun.
Yes. Yeah, you've got that. So, that's out of 6, you've got 4. So, that's good. That's pretty
okay.
good.
All
so,
right.
Well done, yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah, I need to get a leaderboard. going. I think I need to. I've not done that properly, so I can't. I can't say who's. But yeah, some people have done like got 1 out of 6. So yeah, you're doing well. So yeah, that brings us to the end of our episode looking at 3, one of Mulder's darkest hours, really. We've got a pretty epic mythology episode coming up next week. But before we get there, it just leaves me to thank Matt for coming on the show and doing an episode with us. So it's been really great to have you, Matt. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I love talking about the X-Files. I'm more than happy to do it again.
Oh, yes, please. That'd be brilliant. Until you do return, where can people find you online, and what can you point them towards?
The website is www.x-fileslexicon.com. And that's my website. That's like a reference site for the TV show. And we've been around for about 10 years now, and there's a lot of great material, including a lot of in-depth interviews, and, you know, hopefully any new people that aren't aware of the website will come along to look.
Yeah, it is genuinely one of the best X-Files resources on the web. No question about that. The Lexicon is brilliant, and it's got so much on there. So, you know, a lot of you who are listening to this probably know of it already. But if you don't, get over there and check it out, because it is great. And Matt does an amazing amount of hard work to keep that place going and got all the stuff on it. So, yeah, do check it out. It's brilliant. So, until we're back next week, you can obviously find us on Twitter, as I said earlier, at @X_cast, and on Facebook at @TheXcast. We've got a lovely community over there. We've got lots of people talking every day about the X-Files, so do jump in and join us. And yeah, you can find us on iTunes as well if you just type in @TheXcast. It'd be great if you could leave us a rating and a review. We've had some nice ones put on there already, but it'd be even better if you could add to that so we can get even more known amongst X-Files podcasts and beyond. So that would be ace. So yeah, we'll be back next week for One Breath, and Darren Mooney is back again to round off his look at Scully's abduction, given he appeared on the last 2 episodes. So until then, just remember the immortal words: trust no one.